Turbo Girls, we call Kamal and you call Crazy.
Kevin, I know that you had conceptualised previous pop culture TV shows like In the Groove in 1962, then Let's Go in 64, and On the Beat Site in 65, but can you tell us briefly about your vision for the show that eventually became Come On? I believe Hullabaloo was an inspiration.
Oh, yes. I always felt that the pop culture was a mirror of society. In fact, ahead of society. So my pop shows tended to be a touch of current affairs as well, and of course involve fashions, different accents,
staging,
different styles, yes, and the graphic designs of the time.
And of course Go-Go Girls.
Indeed. Absolutely. They were part of the grand design.
Essential. If you want to.
When the pilot for Come On was screened in 1966, it was reviewed as the brightest thing that has happened to New Zealand TV this year. When the NZBC decided to commission 26 Come On shows for 1967, did it come with any restrictions beside budget? Were you given a carte blanche to make the programme that you conceptualised?
Pretty well a carte blanche, except at one stage, the then Director General, one Gilbert Stringer, said, make sure you don't have any of those girls in short skirts dancing in it.
He took no notice of that, I'm pleased to say.
No. Opportunity
is knocking at your heart. Lee, during the Come On years, you had legions of fans and the beginning of a career. Looking back, can you tell us how much Come On actually shaped the person you became and how it prepared you for the career that you've had?
Well, I must admit, when I was doing the show, I was a total idiot. I mean, I hadn't a clue what was going on. All I cared about was the singing bit, you know. I mean, Kevin was God. He gave all the orders. He gave us the numbers to sing. And we would follow orders, basically. Nobody really knew, you know, we were creating history at the time. It's only sort of in retrospect that you realise that, you know, what we did was something pretty amazing because it hadn't happened in New Zealand before. That's why it had such a huge impact on teenagers, on adults, on everybody, really. I can remember one incident as Mr. Lee Grant. I used to wear these enormous wide ties, and because it was live, I had a quick costume change, and I ran out, and instead of putting my tie through the knot, I left it flopping over. And the following morning, I think 80% of the school kids went to school with their ties flopped over. And some of them were expelled because they wore their ties like Mr. Lee Grant wore, which was a total accident. And, of course, I was the bad guy influencing the nation to, you know, to bad habits, you know. So, you know, we were winging it, really. But it's only when you look back on it that you realise that it was something special. And baby, thanks to you, I can make the world a liar.
Thanks to you, I ain't got a call. Were you aware at the time that you were perhaps being groomed for success?
I was very grateful because, I mean, let's face it, I mean, Come On made my career. You know, I mean, I probably would still be in a band in Palmerston North, you know, singing in the local clubs. So, yeah, I'd be eternally grateful for that.
Yeah. Glenn Tucker from the Gremlins actually said that your good looks and superb showmanship made you stand out from the average. It was no surprise to Glenn that once Come On hit our TV screens, you became a pop star. But what was the reality of being a pop star in New Zealand back in 1966? I mean, could you walk to the shop unmolested?
No. Well, it was interesting because, I mean, financially, you didn't have the protection that you do now. So, you know, I'd be mobbed and, you know, the papers were saying, oh, this is all a setup. I mean, I was really annoyed because I got this really nice silk flowery shirt that I actually liked. And the first time that I wore it, it got ripped off my back. I mean, genuinely ripped off my back, you know. I can remember doing a show. The first live show I did, I think it was Matara. And I lasted 30 seconds on stage. but there was no security as such. So they weren't prepared for the, I mean, I literally walked on stage and a thousand girls sort of attacked me and I got concussed. Actually, funny enough, I got concussed by the policeman shoving me into the police car. rather than by the fans, and ended up hospital that evening.
Was that the show where you actually had to swap clothes with a policeman?
It was. They couldn't get me out of the Matara local hall, whatever it was. So I had to kind of wear a policeman's outfit and go out the back. Down on Funky Street,
digging the funky beat. Barbara, how did you get to become one of the Go-Go Girls, and how do you look back on that time when you were a Go-Go dancer on TV?
It was 1967, and Kevin had decided that he wanted a few more just go-go dancers. And so I was dancing at the Monaco. It was a teenage nightclub there in Federal Street at the time. And so Kevin sat with Phil Warren on their chairs, and we individually, the girls who danced up there, had to come out and do their stuff and hopefully be successful. And I was, and just so grateful and just loved it. Part of my life that I treasure.
Tell us about your average week as a go-go dancer, because I believe on Monday you were issued with camera scripts that informed you how to get from A to B on a live set, and it wasn't unusual for go-go girls to be seen crawling along the floor trying to keep out of camera's
vision. Yeah, you had to
vision.
Keep that a shot, yes.
Can't tell us about your week, because it was a busy week, wasn't it?
Oh, it was, yes. There'd be routines to learn for those girls that had to do them, and we had to make sure that we had it just absolutely perfect for the Saturday. And as you know, the show went live. So it was always, after the show, we'd sit in a little room with a little TV screen, and our choreographer, Dolly, would sit there. Now, if you knew that you had made a wrong move, you would be cringing, because you knew what was coming afterwards. But, yeah. So you really, really did strive to do your absolute best for Kevin.
Kevin, I believe that after about 6 episodes, you introduced a new faces element to Come On. It must have been encouraging to uncover bands like The Underdogs. There's a band who, despite their talent, were possibly not what mainstream TV were ready for. It was quite a courageous move bringing The Underdogs on, would you say that in retrospect?
Well, remember that, one, we had to be adventurous. So we had, in general, there was a hostile press and a neutral radio scene. Mm-hmm. So we had to create, to a degree, our own publicity, or alternatively headlines, and being at that cutting edge was part of that deal. Thank you for loving me.
Thank you for being so kind. When the 67 Come On series finished, the brand was kept alive with the Come On tours. That first tour was a massive tour, lasting something like 7 weeks, and it featured Mr. Lee Grant, Sandy Edmonds, the Carlisles, Go-Go Girls, Pete Sinclair, and you had the Underdogs looking after the chicks. And I just wondered, is that some form of reverse psychology?
Yes, it was. It was exactly that, because the chicks were very young, and I felt responsible for them. and that is 7 weeks, so it was a poacher turned gamekeeper view.
Yeah.
So I figured that the most dodgy ones of the group
would be the most responsible.
The ones who would know all the tricks.
I love it.
Come on, right now we want you to meet some old friends from last year's show. With a Beatles pressing called In a Light, it's those crazy Underdogs.
Kevin, I also believe for the second series, you recognised that there was a more sort of psychedelic references that were becoming part of the fashion in 68. Did that cause any waves with your bosses at NZBC, or were your ratings strong enough for you to flex your ideas about the new counterculture?
There was a lack of awareness in the hierarchy of broadcasting circles in those days to what was really going on in the young scene. It was a world, two worlds that did not connect at all.
There was one headline that I thought you probably approved of, which is when the Underdogs were shrouded in a sea of dry ice at one stage, and I think it was the truth headline was NZBC goes to pot. That must have had you rolling in the aisles, that one.
Absolutely. I was a big man yesterday, but boy, you want to see me now.
Lee, fair to say that there's always been a tall poppy syndrome in New Zealand, and I think some of it was directed at you. I think Pete Sinclair was probably the recipient of much of it as well. Was that easy to deal with in those days?
To be perfectly honest, at the time, I wasn't aware of it. I mean, I was an innocent kid, you know, having a good time or not having a good time, and just following orders. This is why I find it really interesting when I hear the behind the scenes, all the wrangling and the record companies and the TV companies and the so-and-so said this and so-and-so said that. It went over my head, to be honest with you. You know, I did enjoy some of it, and some of it I didn't enjoy at all, because it was hard work. And as I say, we didn't have the protection then. So, you know, it was pretty scary, you know, guys trying to square up to me. I'm quite a big bloke, so, you know, I can handle myself. But even so, you know, there was aggression. And, of course, I can understand it. You know, someone's girlfriend going, oh, Mr. Lee Grant that. So you can sort of understand it.
Hi, everybody. Here's some music playing a groove to. It's called a Tighten Up. It's a new dance we also call it Tighten Up. Are you ready? Ow! First we tighten up on the drums.
Bruce, the second series, which went on air the 25th of May through to August 17th, 1968, only 12 weeks for that season, but you got the drumming gig. That must have been like scoring a dream job.
Well, I was very lucky because I was working with Jimmy Sloggett at the time at the Inn at the Park. And as I was led to believe, Kevin wanted to save a bit of money on session time and asked,
would I do that?
And asked Jimmy to get some musicians who could read music. And I was fortunate. I'd just come back from Australia and was working with Jimmy. So he asked me to join the band, and there were three changes made. Dave Russell came in on guitar. Yeah. Mike Walker came in on piano, and I came in on drums. It was only a seven-piece band that year, because Murray Tanner and Jimmy played horns, and it wasn't until the 69 series, I think, that Bernie Allen came in and wrote bigger arrangements with more brass.
Right. And so these recordings were done for the Come On Show. They were pre-recorded at Bruce Barton's studio, Mascot Studios.
Well, the 68 series that I started on was all recorded in the tiny new studio in Shortland Street.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a tiny little studio. We were packed in there, and that's where the first series was done.
Right.
And when they expanded the orchestra, we then went to Mascot, where there was more room.
Right. They would have been really fast sessions, I imagine.
Well, you'd arrive and there'd be 16, 18 charts on your desk, and you were counted off and you rehearsed it once and you recorded it. There was no time for spending a lot of time on the material.
So would you have heard the original version of the material?
Most of my responsibility then was listening to the hit parades of the day and keeping up to date with what was going on. So you sometimes were familiar with the material that you were going to record. You didn't know who was singing it often, you just recorded backing tracks. Just then when the hurdy-gurdy man
came singing songs of love. Shane, tell us how you got the gig for Come On, because I know you had previously paired with the Pleasers, but for the second series, how did you get spotted by Kevin?
Well, very fortunate for me. There was a guy called Gene Pearson who was doing quite well around the traps and singing and so on. Mm-hmm. He was auditioning for the job of Come On resident in 68. Kevin and Phil Warren came along to a club where I was playing, and I was in the backing band. Mm-hmm. And we were backing Gene Pearson. I was working there that evening, and fortunately for me, Kevin caught part of my show and saw me working. I thought, well, I'll give it a go and, you know, make sure that maybe Phil Warren will notice me. And, of course, we had a little chat afterwards, and he spoke about me coming to audition, and, of course, I said, look, I can't leave the band. I couldn't do that, you know, just walk off and leave the guys. So I left at that. Anyway, a couple of days later, I go into rehearsals. And I walk in, and the band are rehearsing a new singer. And I went, hello, hello. Whoops. So I shot straight down to the telephone box and I said, found four pennies and made the call to Phil Warren. And he said, great, there's an audition going tonight up at Shortland Street Studios. And it was as quick as that. And I went up that evening and did my audition, picked a couple of songs off the band's song sheet. I did my thing, and then Kevin had a chat with me, and he advised me how difficult and hard work it was going to be, and would I be committed. And so on. Of course, I said, yes, I would. And we said, well, anyway, we'll get back to you. We'll let you know the old story. And I think it was the next morning, Phil Warren, I called him. He said, congratulations, you're now a resident on Come On, coming up. So that was how fast it happened for me. There's a dam called the Alligator. At that time, like Lee said, he didn't know much about TV performing. I'd been on TV, a few rock shows and things in Australia, and I'd even appeared on Come On 67 with the Pleasers. But I still didn't know what I was doing either, and Kevin came along and he really did. He was a hard taskmaster, but he instilled discipline into the whole situation, and I learnt so much in those formative days on Come On 68. Yeah. And he did have you on tenterhooks sometimes, Kevin. Yes. He used to make me a nervous wreck sometimes. And there was one particular time, you know, you'd wing it sometimes because suddenly you're doing gigs all over the country. You're doing this TV series. You're trying to keep up with new songs every week.
Yeah.
So you'd wing it a little bit, you know. You get to the gig, I've got all day to learn the miming and get it right. And there was one particular day I remember, I was just not getting the song right, and this voice came from above. Shane, you better get that correct at the next rehearsal, or your television career is going to come to a very abrupt end. And I will. So I've never forgotten those words, and from then on I didn't wing it anymore. I really worked on those lyrics. I want to find somebody to care. I want to get some rice in my hair. I need love, but I want you, I do. I want to spend my life loving you.
Were you always comfortable with some of the material that you had to perform?
We had, we'd have a production meeting, I think it was Tuesday mornings with Kevin and the rest of the crew. And that's where we would choose the songs for the forthcoming show. We all wanted to do the cool songs and all that sort of thing. You know, there was the competition between Ray, Tommy Ferguson and whoever. And I was the same. And I want to do the soul-y song. I want to do the funky one. But it was always, I ended up usually with Rice is Nice and the cutesy-cutesy stuff.
Not
and
Cuddly
Kevin,
Toy.
Yeah, and Cuddly Toy. And Kevin put it down to typecasting. And that was very, he said, no, you're a cutesy-cutesy one. That's what you got to sing. So do as you're told. And it worked. Anyway, sir. You say you want to donate your life to the future. They say they've got dues to pay today. You say it's the fool who plays it cool, sir. And if tomorrow comes, you know they'll all hear St. Paul say, let me take you down. Shane, in 1969 you had a massive success with St. Paul.
Would you consider that your exposure on Come On the second and third series prepared you for that success, especially, as Lee says, at radio?
It prepared me for that success, but it also brought that success. You know, by 1969, a second series had well established myself as a top pop singer in New Zealand anyway, and so I was out there doing it all over the place, and when I had St. Paul out, working on the gold disc, and Kevin produced that as well. And of course I did it, I performed it on Come On.
Yeah.
And it was a number one for 6 weeks, and due down to people like Radio Hierarchy and the actual presentation of doing it on the show with, yeah, on Come On.
Actually, between Come On and Hierarchy, yeah, you pretty there much had ubiquity, really.
It was a star machine.
Exactly.
Basically, which does lack now, I think, in that same way. Everything was helping you, and everyone worked together. There was no animosity between the artists. We all encouraged each other, we all helped each other, and we backed each other, you know, and we worked together on live shows. It was a great camaraderie. I wouldn't it be nice to get on with me neighbours? But they make it very clear they've got no room for ravers.
Kevin, getting the performance from the artist that you know will translate for TV, how different is that process from the live show scenario? What are you actually looking for from the artist as a TV producer?
You're looking for character, because those close-ups are vital. Mm-hmm. They make or break, regardless of how spectacular the setting may be. how many people are involved. You've got to focus on that face and that personality that comes out of it.
In 1969, Come On got a third series, and then I believe it was axed or discontinued by mutual consent. Can you tell us why that was?
It had really done its run in the format that it was in. Because of various constrictions, which were size of studio, talent pool, money, we had to condense all our material from between about 1.5 to 2 minutes per song type of thing. Mm-hmm. Because when we're asking performers to do these various styles, they could only carry that on for a certain amount of time. And the techniques, visual and oral, to get it there sort of start to run out after that magic sort of period. Mm-hmm. But then the material changed.
Right.
The scene changed. This was, even though the older generation at the time may not have liked it very much, it was a family show. Mm-hmm. And so the lyrics that you can brush aside on radio, mm-hmm. when people are actually singing them, you see them singing them, then the words become more important, and the overtones of the drugs, the sex, mm-hmm. the rock and roll's okay, but the first two are a problem with the family show.
No regrets, no tears goodbye.
Would you consider that Come On changed the perception of how the public viewed New Zealand talent? Because there was a bit of a cultural cringe back then, and being a musician wasn't always viewed as a career as such, would you think?
Oh, yes. Definitely. Look, they had pop polls, like they still do, but we had local music papers at that stage that had pop polls in them, and they had local artists up there with the international artists. I won one World Singers poll. I was above people like Engelbert Humperdinck and various international singers. Elvis, I think, was above me. That was about it. And I was second, you know, and that was an amazing thing. And these were votes by kids here in New Zealand voting for their favourite artist. So it did definitely happen. And they actually saw us as on the same stage as the international artists. We weren't just there was no more cringing. And we were making good records at that stage,
right.
That did compete with the international songs.
Bruce, did you ever have any trouble convincing your parents that being a drummer was a career?
Of course. I gave up a good day job to do it. But the ability to, week to week, be every other man's drummer, whereas we're talking about material, I had to be Deep Purple's drummer, the Yardbirds' drummer, so you had to change all these and be able to play all these styles to record this frenetic paced show. There were very few ballads apart from yours, Shane, that I remember, mm-hmm. because the pace of the show just kept going. Most of the stuff was bright upbeat stuff, and it wasn't until we went into Happen In later when it became ballads became popular.
Farewell to the land of hits and happenings. Until 6:30 next Saturday, you'll join us then, right? Because don't forget, you've got a date on Come On 68.
Kevin, in 1975, you took over as head of programming, and in 76, you gave Peter Grattan the go-ahead to launch Radio with Pictures. My feeling is that New Zealand music has much to thank you for.
Well, that's very nice to say. You say that.
Yes.
But I couldn't possibly comment, could I?
Well, in fairness, you established a cultural TV template for pop culture with a variety of shows there, but you also were generous enough to hand it on to the likes of people with Peter Grattan and put on a different type of show. Radio with Pictures was destination viewing for people like myself, yeah. as a student.
Well, I think the Prime Minister of the country has just given a good demonstration of knowing when it's time to move on to other things and leave a heritage behind you.
tour lasting something like 7 weeks, and it featured Mr. Lee Grant, Sandy Edmonds, the Carlisles, Go Go Girls, Pete Sinclair, and you had the underdogs looking after the chicks. And I just wondered, is that some form of reverse psychology?
Yes, it was. It was exactly that, because the chicks were very young,
yeah.
And I felt responsible for them, and that is 7 weeks. So it was a poacher turned gamekeeper view.
Yeah.
So I figured that the most dodgy ones of the group
would be the most responsible.
The ones who would know all the tricks.
I love it.
Come on, right now we want you to meet some old friends from last year's show. With a Beatles pressing called Inner Light, it's those crazy underdogs.
Kevin, I also believe for the second series, you recognised that there was a more sort of psychedelic references that were becoming part of the fashion in 68. Did that cause any waves with your bosses at NZBC, or were your ratings strong enough for you to flex your ideas about the new counterculture?
There was a lack of awareness in the hierarchy of broadcasting circles in those days to what was really going on in the young scene. It was a world, two worlds that did not connect at all.
There was one headline that I thought you probably approved of, which is when the underdogs were shrouded in a sea of dry ice at one stage, and that, I think it was the truth headline was NZBC goes to pot. That must have had you rolling in the aisles, that one.
Absolutely.
I was a big man yesterday, but boy, you want to see me now.
Lee, fair to say that there's always been a tall poppy syndrome in New Zealand, and I think some of it was directed at you. I think Pete Sinclair was probably the recipient of much of it as well. Was that easy to deal with in those days?
To be perfectly honest, at the time, I wasn't aware of it. I mean, I was an innocent kid, you know, having a good time or not having a good time, and just following orders. This is why I find it really interesting when I hear the behind the scenes, all the wrangling and the record companies and the TV companies and the so-and-so said this and so-and-so said that. It went over my head, to be honest with you. You know, I did enjoy some of it, and some of it I didn't enjoy at all, because it was hard work. And as I say, we didn't have the protection then. So, you know, it was pretty scary, you know, guys trying to square up to me. I'm quite a big bloke, so, you know, I can handle myself. But even so, you know, there was aggression. And of course, I can understand it. You know, someone's girlfriend going, oh, Mr. Lee Grant, that. So you can sort of understand it.
Hi, everybody. Here's a music playing a groove to. It's called a Tighten Up. And it's a new dance we also call a Tighten Up. Are you ready?
Bruce, the second series, which went on air the 25th of May through to August 17th, 1968, only 12 weeks for that season, but you got the drumming gig. That must have been like scoring a dream job.
Well, I was very lucky because I was working with Jimmy Sloggett at the time at the Inn at the Park. And as I was led to believe, Kevin wanted to save a bit of money on session time. And asked,
would I do that?
And asked Jimmy to get some musicians who could read music. And I was fortunate. I'd just come back from Australia and was working with Jimmy. So he asked me to join the band. And there were three changes made. Dave Russell came in on guitar.
Yeah.
Mike Walker came in on piano. And I came in on drums. It was only a seven-piece band that year because Murray Tanner and Jimmy played horns. And it wasn't until the 69 series, I think, that Bernie Allen came in and wrote bigger arrangements with more brass.
Right. And so these recordings were done for the Come On Show. They were pre-recorded at Bruce Barton's studio, Mascot Studios.
Well, the 68 series that I started on was all recorded in the tiny new studio in Shortland Street.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a tiny little studio. We were packed in there, and that's where the first series was done.
Right.
And when they expanded the orchestra, we then went to Mascot, where there was more room.
Right. They would have been really fast sessions, I imagine.
Well, you'd arrive and there'd be 16, 18 charts on your desk, and you were counted off and you rehearsed it once and you recorded it. There was right. no time for spending a lot of time on the material.
So would you have heard the original version of the material?
Most of my responsibility then was listening to the hit parades of the day and keeping up to date with what was going on. So you sometimes were familiar with the material that you were going to record. You didn't know who was singing it often, you just recorded backing tracks.
Just then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love.
Shane, tell us how you got the gig for Come On, because I know you had previously appeared with The Pleasers, but for the second series, how did you get spotted by Kevin?
Well, very fortunate for me. There was a guy called Gene Pearson who was doing quite well around the traps and singing and so on.
Mm-hmm.
He was auditioning for the job of Come On resident in 68. Kevin and Phil Warren came along to a club where I was playing, and I was in the backing band. Mm-hmm. And we were backing Gene Pearson. I was working there that evening, and fortunately for me, Kevin caught part of my show and saw me working. I thought, well, I'll give it a go and, you know, make sure that maybe Phil Warren will notice me. And of course, we had a little chat afterwards, and he spoke about me coming to audition. And of course, I said, look, I can't leave the band. I couldn't do that, you know, just walk off and leave the guys. So I left at that. Anyway, a couple of days later, I go into rehearsals. And I walk in, and the band are rehearsing a new singer. And I went, hello, hello. Whoops. So I shot straight down to the telephone box, and I said, found four pennies, and made the call to Phil Warren. And he said, great, there's an audition going tonight up at Shortland Street Studios. And it was as quick as that. And I went up that evening and did my audition. Picked a couple of songs off the band's song sheet. I did my thing, and then Kevin had a chat with me, and he advised me how difficult and hard work it was going to be, and if would I be committed, and so on. Of course, I said, yes, I would. And we said, anyway, we'll get back to you. We'll let you know the old story. And I think it was the next morning, Phil Warren, I called him. He said, congratulations, you're now a resident on Come On coming up. So that was how fast it happened for me. At that time, like Lee said, he didn't know much about TV performing. I'd been on TV a few rock shows and things in Australia, and I'd even appeared on Come On 67 with The Pleasers. But I still didn't know what I was doing either, and Kevin came along, and he really did. He was a hard taskmaster, but he instilled discipline into the whole situation, and I learnt so much in those formative days on Come On 68.
Yeah.
And he did have you on tenterhooks sometimes, Kevin.
Yes.
He used to make me a nervous wreck sometimes. And there was one particular time, you know, you'd wing it sometimes, because suddenly you're doing gigs all over the country. You're doing this TV series. You're trying to keep up with new songs every week.
Yeah.
So you'd wing it a little bit, you know. You get to the gig, I've got all day to learn the miming and get it right. And there was one particular day I remember, I was just not getting the song right, and this voice came from above, Shane, you better get that correct at the next rehearsal, or your television career is going to come to a very abrupt end. And I will. So, I've never forgotten those words, and from then on I didn't wing it anymore. I really worked on those lyrics.
I want to find somebody to care. I want to get some rice in my hair. I need love when I want you, I do. I want to spend my life loving you.
Were you always comfortable with some of the material that you had to perform?
We had, we'd have a production meeting, I think it was Tuesday mornings, with Kevin and the rest of the crew. And that's where we would choose the songs for the forthcoming show. We all wanted to do the cool songs and all that sort of thing. You know, there was competition between Ray, Tommy Ferguson and whoever. And I was the same. And I want to do the soul-y song. I want to do the funky one. But it was always, I ended up usually with Rice is Nice and the cutesy-cutesy stuff.
Not Cuddly
Kevin,
Toy.
Yeah, and Cuddly Toy. And Kevin put it down to typecasting. And that was very, he said, no, you're a cutesy-cutesy one. That's what you got to sing. So do as you're told. And it worked, anyway. So.
You say you want to donate your life to the future. They say they've got dues to pay today. You say it's the fool who plays in cool, sir. And if tomorrow
Shane, in 1969 you had a massive success with St. Paul. Would you consider that your exposure on Come On the second and third series prepared you for that success, especially, as Lee says, at radio?
It prepared me for that success, but it also brought that success. You know, by 1969, a second series had well established myself as a top pop singer in New Zealand anyway, and so I was out there doing it all over the place, and when I had St. Paul out, working on the gold disc, and Kevin produced that as well. And of course I did it, I performed it on Come On, and it was a number one for 6 weeks, and due down to people like Radio Hierarchy and the actual presentation of doing it on the show with on Come On.
Actually, between Come On and Hierarchy, you pretty much had ubiquity, really.
It was a star machine.
Exactly.
Basically, which does lack now, I think, in that same way. Everything was helping you, and everyone worked together. There was no animosity between the artists. We all encouraged each other, we all helped each other, and we backed each other, you know, and we worked together on live shows. It was a great camaraderie.
Oh, wouldn't it be nice to get on with me neighbours? But they make it very clear they've got no room for ravers.
Kevin, getting the performance from the artist that you know will translate for TV, how different is that process from the live show scenario? What are you actually looking for from the artist as a TV producer?
You're looking for character, because those close-ups are vital. They make or break, regardless of how spectacular the setting may be, how many people are involved. You've got to focus on that face and that personality that comes out of it.
In 1969, Come On got a third series, and then I believe it was axed or discontinued by mutual consent. Can you tell us why that was?
It had really done its run in the format that it was in. Because of various constrictions, which were size of studio, talent pool, money, we had to condense all our material from between about 1.5 to 2 minutes per song type of thing. Because when we're asking performers to do these various styles, they could only carry that on for a certain amount of time. And the techniques are visual and oral to get it there sort of start to run out after that magic sort of period. But then the material changed.
Right.
The scene changed. This was, even though the older generation at the time may not have liked it very much, it was a family show. And so the lyrics that you can brush aside on radio, when people are actually singing them, you see them singing them, then the words become more important, and the overtones of the drugs, the sex. The rock and roll's okay, but the first two are a problem with the family show.
No regrets, no tears goodbye.
Would you consider that Come On changed the perception of how the public viewed New Zealand talent? Because there was a bit of a cultural cringe back then, and being a musician wasn't always viewed as a career as such, would you think?
Oh, yes. Definitely. Look, they had pop polls, like they still do, but we had local music papers at that stage that had pop polls in them, and they had local artists up there with the international artists. I won one World Singers poll. I was above people like Engelbert Humperdinck and various international singers. Elvis, I think, was above me. That was about it. And I was second, you know, and that was an amazing thing. And these were votes by kids here in New Zealand voting for their favourite artist. So it did definitely happen. And they actually saw us as on the same stage as the international artists. We weren't just sort of... There was no more cringing. And we were making good records at that stage.
Right.
That did compete with the international songs.
Bruce, did you ever have any trouble convincing your parents that being a drummer was a career?
Of course. I gave up a good day job to do it.
Okay.
But the ability to, week to week, be every other man's drummer, whereas we're talking about material, I had to be Deep Purple's drummer, the Yardbirds drummer, so you had to change all these and be able to play all these styles to record this frenetic-paced show. There were very few ballads, apart from yours, Shane, that I remember, because the pace of the show just kept going. Most of the stuff was bright, upbeat stuff, and it wasn't until we went into Happen In later when it became ballads became popular.
So we bid farewell to the land of hits and happenings until 6:30 next Saturday. You'll join us then, right, because don't forget, you've got a date on Come On 68.
Kevin, in 1975, you took over as head of programming, and in 76, you gave Peter Grattan the go-ahead to launch Radio with Pictures. My feeling is that New Zealand music has much to thank you for.
Well, it's very nice to say. But I couldn't possibly comment, could I?
Well, in fairness, you established a cultural TV template for pop culture with a variety of shows there. But you also were generous enough to hand it on to the likes of people with Peter Grattan and put on a different type of show. Radio with Pictures was destination viewing for people like myself as a student.
Well, I think the Prime Minister of the country has just given a good demonstration of knowing when it's time to move on to other things and leave a heritage behind you.